Welcome to the Flannery Podcast. This is episode 27, the issue, Trump lying and inciting violence, doing anything to win. Stay tuned.
Where the road is dark and the seed is sown, where the gun is cocked as the bullets comb, where the miles are marked,
like many of you, I listened to the Talking Head shows on Sunday today before making this podcast, and I found that the TV and cable hosts were overmatched by their administration, mostly guests, when they tried to get an answer to the questions they asked, when they talked over each other, argued about whether the question was fair. All that came out was lying agitprop talking points. The ultimate final response was an exercise in misdirection and a couple of real whoppers. That's prompted my new rule. Since lies by Republicans of every sort, in and out of government, in and out of the cabinet, from the highest to the lowest in the Republican pantheon, have approached 100% lying, answering with a lying whopper on every topic, however insignificant, well, then we don't regard anything they say anything but a lie. We should agree as a people, make a social contract not to rely on anything these people say, from the liar king tyrant Trump, all the way down the Republican food chain to the doorman at the White House. We have seen experienced journalists wrestle in real time to uncover no more than a fraction of the lies told. So much deception gets through. And there's part of the problem. We should just label every one of these dunderheads with a consumer warning that you can't believe a thing these Republicans say. It's one reason why I don't see the purpose of a debate, that is, between Biden and Trump, if no news organization can assure us that they will have Trump respect the forum and rules applied to the forum. And we know that no news organization can effectively fact-check in real time. Speaker Pelosi has nailed this one right. There's no need for a debate, not with this clown. Margaret Sullivan, who writes terrific opinions, wrote a comment in today's Sunday's Post that said, "To fact-check Trump's lies is fruitless." Well, you know, when I saw that headline, I thought I'd agree with her column, but I felt she surrendered to the liar king when she quoted Charlie Wartsell, also of the Post, who said, "America has no shared reality." Well, what about the possibility that these liars well know they are lying to conceal truth in order to win an election? You have to have a shared reality with people who are being honest about what they believe and what they know and what they say. Margaret also quoted Scotty Nell Hughes, who was a surrogate for Trump in the 2016 camp, who said on the Diane Rehm radio show, quote, "There's no such thing, unfortunately anymore, as facts." Margaret's conclusion was that belief, therefore, takes the place of fact. Well, there's no other way to say it. She's wrong. Republicans make this argument that we each have our own belief. We're entitled to our own belief. But a belief is not a truth, not a fact. It's a subjective perception. Or it has no basis by which one can test it. One belief against another belief instead of against a truth or a fact. Ari Melber, who hosts The Beat, had a forum at Cooper Union on the impeachment, and I was honored to be asked to participate in it. My assignment was to discuss Trump's obstruction. And another assignment I had was to respond to a conservative speaker at the end of the lineup. And it was about the impeachment and about what Trump had done or not done with Ukraine in terms of asking for a favor. Was there bribery, etc., and so forth. The conservative had said that you can't hold Trump accountable for bribing or coercing Ukraine because the test is what he believed was going on. What he believed. when Ari called me up to the stage to respond, and he gave me the full stage, I stepped up to the very edge of the stage, and I faced the audience, and after a couple of remarks, I said, "When my daughter was young, I used to sing a song for her. And it went, 'I believe I can fly.'" And it repeated that again and again, "I believe I can fly." And so it was a belief. And with that thought, at Cooper Union, at the edge of the stage, I raised my arms and said, "With this belief, I can leap off this stage and soar over you." And a few up front gasped that I might end up in their laps, and maybe they were just acting. I paused and I said, "But I'm not delusional." A belief is no substitute for intent measured by words and actions, that is, by facts and truth. Margaret said she was with Warsel, that we don't have a common ground to share. I disagree. Fact and truth and logic and empathy are real and universal. There are always those working the big con, but the fact that they don't share truth with us makes them only liars. It's not a question of sharing reality. For them, these things don't exist. There's only the manipulation. The manipulation of the public. You can't share a common ground with a grifter. Long ago, when asked what I thought about something Trump said on TV, I'd say without reservation, he lies about everything, and I would just dismiss what he would say. I would counter the argument with facts, however, because I thought it was important to also show how he was a liar. And I was saying this before he was elected, that he was a liar. I thought it was important, however, to underscore that Trump is not a reliable witness, only a reliable liar. The only time I believe you can trust what he says is when he makes a spectacular admission. And he does that, like when he said he was firing Comey because he wanted to stop the investigation, or he was paying off Cohen, his fixer lawyer, the hush money that Cohen advanced on his behalf to keep those women quiet. You know, in the political odd couple of Trump and Giuliani made a fair number of inculpatory admissions. Strange kind of law. I joked, I think, at one point that I thought Rudy was trying to build a defense of ineffective assistance of counsel, so whenever there was a trial, they could say the admissions weren't admissible because he had done such a bad job advising his client. I did think Rudy should be arrested for impersonating a lawyer. But the corrective reaction to what Trump said and did was mostly to do nothing. Others didn't call him out. They kind of shaded formal. He didn't understand. He didn't know exactly what he was doing. And, you know, maybe that was understandable at the very beginning. But at one point after that long campaign, and even several days in office, when he begins by lying about the size of crowds, how can you possibly not take those data points and say, "Whoa, advisory, this guy doesn't tell the truth"? I do these walk and talks daily, you know, while I'm walking the country all around as I walk. And I talk a lot about the madness and desperation that has gripped Trump of late, with the fear that he's likely going to get the heave-ho, even if we only block half his underhanded tricks and deceptions. Of late, all his worst impulses are on display. He lies more. He suppresses information more. He goes boldly where no ethical law-abiding president went before. He incites violence, denies that he did, and blame shifts that someone else is responsible for any violence that may occur. So, I thought we should analyze, notwithstanding any warning label about all politicians, all Republicans anyhow, how he focuses his lies, how he suppresses information, and how he incites violence. Stay tuned. The biggest lies he tells has to do with the pandemic and racism and interference in the elections, both 2016 and this one, 2020. First, let's talk about the pandemic a little bit. We have gone through Trump's hoax stage. You know, he said this was only a hoax, it's not real, the virus is just a hoax and it'll be gone away soon and there's nothing to it and nobody will be hurt. But now we have millions of infected persons, more than any place else on the planet, and thousands upon thousands of those who are dead, more than any other place on the planet. Still, Trump pushes to open businesses and schools without adequate safety protection from the virus. During the Republican National Convention, the RNC, Trump wrongly commandeered the White House for a political event. His closing speech, his acceptance of the nomination from the party. We saw people spread across the South Lawn to hear his meandering, lying attack. We saw his ditto head shaking hands shoulder to shoulder, sitting next to each other without masks, to listen to the man who looks directly into an eclipse of the sun, risking their health and their lives to the virus, to hear how he thinks he's going to win this election. Mary Trump has released a couple of statements over time, and she made some observations about how Trump operates when she watched this same event.
We're seeing this scene that is on the little screen while you're there, of all of these people packed in, which what could be a COVID super spreader event at the White House.
It is remarkable the size of that crowd and how close everybody is. I mean, I've seen one or two masks the whole time that we have been watching. There's one in the scene. But look, I mean, that doesn't look like America in 2020.
No.
No, of course, absolutely.
I mean, I totally agree. It's disturbing for us to watch it because we're covering COVID every day. Does Donald Trump actually care? Because, you know, there is some reporting that he changed his mind about sending help to states for hurricanes when he was told, well, these are our people that could die. Do you think that he cares that some of his own people could get sick and maybe die by being at this event at the White House?
No, not at all. Because what is important to him is that people think that everything's fine. And tonight is of a piece with what I've seen of the rest of the convention. It's an attempt to elide the last 6 months from the country's memory and pretend that 2020 never happened. And basically, nobody died, the economy's great, and that lie can't be pulled off unless he has people crowding into the lawn of the People's House, by the way, which is another issue entirely, that they're all breaking the law by even doing it in the first place. And the risks that those people are taking or the risks he's putting them at are completely irrelevant to him, because for Donald, the only thing that matters is if he is winning in the moment.
Because Trump doesn't follow the guidance of his own experts. He leads many Americans into error that could threaten their well-being and cost them their lives. Trump invites them to participate, not in a different reality, sorry, Margaret, but in a fantasy. We have reports from the first night of the RNC in North Carolina that some attendees have already been diagnosed with the virus. How could it have been otherwise? How many more will there be? We've seen this Herman Cain roulette play out before, and I'm referring to Herman, who was a candidate himself for president. But you may remember he attended a Trump rally. There are pictures of him. He didn't distance. He didn't wear a mask. And he happened to get the virus, and he died. Brilliant. An example of suppressing and distorting the truth is what we see happened in the CDC, which also relates to the pandemic. That is, controlling it, knowing what's going on. Trump has been saying if we did fewer tests, we'd have fewer infected persons. Now, there's a corrupt notion. Trump said, I said to my people, slow the testing down, please. You've probably heard him say this on the news. This past week, the CDC did just what he wanted. It offered new guidance that those without symptoms don't have to be tested. Keep in mind, those who are asymptomatic can carry the virus and infect others. And that is why you quarantine these people and you test them, because they've been near someone. It teaches us about the spread. It teaches us about where the infection may go. It helps us protect people. The old rule was that everyone who had been in close contact with an infected person should get tested to find out whether they contracted the virus, asymptomatic or otherwise. California Governor Newsom said, this CDC policy, it's not going to be the policy of the state of California, with good reason. Washington Governor Jay Inslee said the guidance would cause his state to miss thousands of new cases and allow the virus to spread in our communities. He told his state, if you've been exposed to a confirmed case, get tested. New York Governor Cuomo said the change was indefensible. The new guidance also doesn't call on anyone to self-isolate for 2 weeks, which was the old rule. An epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, said the White House intervened in the drafting of CDC guidance about masks and reopening of churches and schools. So that process has really poisoned people's view of the guidelines. We can't trust them anymore. And trust is so important to, you know, relying on what the CDC says. Fauci continues to be a hero, having not been scarred by the forces that come from the West Wing to suppress and change and distort information about the pandemic. Let's move on to a second topic, racism. The lies about racism are more complicated. On the one hand, Trump will say, I'm not a racist, evoking memories of Nixon saying he wasn't a crook, nor anti-Semitic, nor a racist. But we have too many data points about who Trump truly is. You know, truth, facts. We remember his campaign launch down a golden escalator with paid extras, clappers, so he could attack Mexicans with people approving his rhetoric. We've seen what he did about Charlottesville when it came to saying the white supremacists and racists were good folk when they were nothing of the sort. And in fact, the lady was overrun by one of their number and killed. But, you know, that doesn't bother Trump. Trump attacks those who are protesting the racist killings by police officers and the proofs that racism is systemic. Now, how can you explain that? There's really only one way. You have to be a racist to resist the charge that is before your eyes and proven by so many cell phones. Trump ignores, therefore, the objective of the demonstrations and goes after the demonstrations and the demonstrators as if they are disembodied and separate and apart from what they are fighting to uphold. That's racial justice. That is equal treatment before the law. Some say the protesters should back off. And I don't know if it's a long life of seeing these kinds of things play out. They have the support of these people, but they're anxious about the argument. And violence does make us necessarily and rightly uncomfortable. They are anxious it doesn't look good. It's messy. There are police. There is damage. It's disconcerting. But free speech, if it's to be effective, must often be robust. This is not a dinner party. This is something we've been fighting since the Declaration of Independence, and fits and starts with advances and setbacks. These protests are almost exclusively about the life and death of persons who are black, persons of color. How do you make that calculus? No one can doubt the truth of the wrongs that have been suffered. No one can deny what cell phones captured. These violent acts by police in broad daylight. The sequence of incidents proves the point. It's not going away by itself. And the remedies have been slow coming. Trump would rather silence the demonstrators or provoke violence so that their cause go unheard without remediation. There's a justice bill over in the Senate that the House passed. Crickets. There are all sorts of provisions to right the wrongs that blacks have suffered and to start making a difference to systemic racism, particularly among the police. The protest continues because their cause has gone unheard without a remedy. Let's consider a couple of the obvious examples, and there are more. A black man is choked to death because he is suspected of passing a bogus $20 bill. That's what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis. And that was a catalyst that just set a fire across the nation of people that said enough is enough. We cannot put up with this. This cannot stand. We have to act. Another black man was shot 7 times in the back just days ago, and he's paralyzed. And all he did, to those who saw the video, is he walked around his car, opened the driver's side car door. That's what happened to Jacob Blake. Is it contempt of cop? I told you to do something, you didn't do it, so I can shoot you 7 times. After the fact, they say there was a knife on the floor of the car, but he had barely gotten into the car, according to the video, when they shot him 7 times in the back. There was nothing between doing nothing and shooting Jacob, apparently. Those were the only choices they considered. They didn't think to seize him, to cuff him. Of course, I'm assuming they had probable cause for some criminal charge, some reason to hold them, but I haven't heard what that is either. Blake was shot in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Now, also in Kenosha, Wisconsin, when there were demonstrations, a lone young gunman, Kyle Rittenhouse, 17 years old, traveled from Illinois to Kenosha with an AR-15, according to a reporter on the ground. He circulated with other gun-wielding men. More and more of these armed persons are appearing and saying they're there to help the police. I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. These guys, I'm from the community. You don't know who I am, but I'm here to, I don't know, help you the way I think I should. Some police said over a loudspeaker, "We appreciate you guys. We really do." Just what they need, armed men and a teen they don't know. They armed, self-appointed, basically vigilantes. And it's beyond all understanding that anyone would want this X factor in a situation as volatile as a protest against something as serious as racist police killing persons of color. But Kyle walked the streets armed with an AR-15, a lot more powerful than a knife, on his body. He wasn't stopped. And you can see the videos of this, him walking up and down the streets. In a video, an interview, Kyle said it was our job to help people and protect property. Yeah, right. He traveled from Illinois to protect a gas station, because that's what he said he was doing there, protecting property. But when he was walking up and down the streets and running in the streets, as you see in these videos, he wasn't protecting anything. Now, several provisions of the Wisconsin Code prohibit private paramilitary and unauthorized law enforcement activity. So what happened? Kyle is accused of killing 2 people in Kenosha. So the cops shot a black man 7 times, and they ignored a young white man, 17, with an AR-15 walking up and down the street, and he kills 2 people. What kind of law enforcement is that? Also, by the way, and you've probably seen it somewhere, Kyle had attended a Trump rally, and he sat in the front row, and if you've seen the picture, they have a circle around his picture, and Trump is speaking at that rally. Now, Kenosha. Trump has now announced he's going to Kenosha on Tuesday. No one wants him there. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes says, "We don't need that right now." You look at the incendiary remarks that the president has made, the lieutenant governor said. They centered an entire convention around creating more animosity and creating more division around what is going on in Kenosha. Kenosha mayor agreed. "I don't need more guns on the streets in this city when we're trying to keep people safe." We can expect Trump to be seen, I'll bet you, with the local police. Not with the mayor, not with the lieutenant governor, not with the governor, not with the family. Well, you know, if it is, that'll be pretty amazing. And he'll be with these wrong-headed police who are busy defending the shooting. Amazing. They're going to probably attack the protesters and perhaps support the shooter who was a gunman walking up and down the streets. Sad. Let's turn to a discussion, kind of the third prong I mentioned, about Trump hides who he is and what he did wrong when he interfered in the elections, both 2016 and 2020 this year. Stay tuned. Trump stole the 2016 election with a combine of Russian support, lies, and breaks he got from the likes of FBI Director Comey, who opened and closed an investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails. And the last mention in which he closed it was only days before the election. It was misrepresented by Trump that they had an indictment sealed that they were going to release after the election. Fox covered it exactly that way. Recently, the Senate intelligence findings were that there was Russian participation and collusion in Trump's 2016 campaign. The Republicans said there was no collusion, but the Democrats said this is what collusion looks like. So that should be a blockbuster. But why doesn't it get the play that it does when it's about how they interfered? And we have intelligence the Russians are interfering again. Just today, there's been another special development. The New York Times uncovered the role that Rod Rosenstein played at the so-called Just Us Department, protecting Donald Trump from the Mueller investigation. Rosenstein took steps to narrow the investigation. Rosenstein kept Mueller's investigators from completing an examination of President Trump's decades-long personal and business ties with Russia. There was a puzzling footnote that bothered me in the final Mueller report that said the FBI had to do some investigation of Trump. But it wasn't clear that such an investigation was off-limits to Mueller himself. I did wonder if he didn't finish his investigation, if there remained things that he thought could have implicated Trump that he didn't investigate himself. The biggest criticism of Mueller was, why did he hand in a report and stop at the water's edge, if you will, of Trump, the family, and the finances? Rosenstein, he had written and published directions to Mueller. And it was to examine any links and or coordination between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. That was the public assignment we all read. So we assumed that that covered the waterfront, so to speak. But there was a private communication to Mueller. He was instructed to conduct only a criminal investigation into whether anyone broke the law in connection with Russia's 2016 election interference. Keep in mind that DOJ, if no one else, insists that a sitting president can't be prosecuted for a crime. So it insulated Trump and his finances and his family from being prosecuted. They didn't have to get to Sessions to pull back this investigation. They had Rosenstein to do the dirty work. That was about the 2016 election. Now, we have what Trump did to interfere in this election. Trump was rightly impeached for trying to run down Biden, the candidate he feared the most, who is now the nominee of the party, and he sought to compromise him in this presidential election by making a corrupt bargain with the Ukraine, asking for a favor to commence a bogus investigation by the Ukraine of Biden and discrediting him so that Trump would, as a reciprocal part of the deal, the quid pro quo, haven't heard that in a while, release the defense spending that Ukraine needed to defend itself against Trump's puppeteer, Putin, on the eastern border, threatening Russian aggression. Follow? That impeachment started when a whistleblower filed a complaint with the Director of National Intelligence, DNI. Now, after the Republicans shunned their constitutional obligation and acquitted Trump at the impeachment trial, Trump fired or demoted anyone having anything to do with his impeachment, that is, who was unfriendly. And that included the head of the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. So, who did they get to replace him? Former Congressman John Ratcliffe. Now, Ratcliffe was a hero to Trump and the White House, because he was very aggressive during the impeachment hearings on behalf of Trump, defending Trump. So he was appointed, and I guess he was considered safe, but there was a Hill briefing that talked about how they were giving bounties for killing Americans. And this had a big play in the press, and so they don't want to have another mistake like that so close to the election. So now Ratcliffe won't be giving any briefings on the Hill. He's going to give written reports. And you can be sure that the phraseology in those reports will have that elusive bureaucratic language that is so opaque and misleading. Another line of misconduct is the resistance from Trump to turn over his tax returns, old subject, I know, to D.A. Vance in New York. This Tuesday, I'm hoping that the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, where I clerked and argued when I was a prosecutor, will brush past any remaining frivolous objections by Trump to stop his accountant from producing these records. And I also think that the Supreme Court is going to say enough is enough and not entertain another application. The question is, will D.A. Vance, the district attorney in Manhattan County, will he have enough time to indict if the goods are there before the statute of limitations run? And that's why Trump and company are running the clock on it. Also, there must be something in those documents. Now let's talk a little bit about civil disobedience. What is it? Is that what we're observing in Portland and Kenosha? Stay tuned. Those who are protesting know why it's necessary, why it's just. You've likely heard black men recently, choked up, saying they fear for themselves, but more so for their sons. They have the talk, how to handle a situation, how to be calm if you're confronted by a police officer so that you can return home safely and with dignity. Others who are not black see this injustice and share the cause as well because it's so outrageous and it's confirmed by these modern techniques, you know, cell phones. What kind of government lets racial inequality persist? From the time of the Declaration of Independence that said all were equal when they weren't, through years of slavery, not cured by a brutal civil war that guaranteed citizenship and the vote for slaves. Were the advances gutted by discriminatory practices, Jim Crow laws, lynchings, and the bizarre notion that keeping blacks separate was equal when it was anything but equal? So what is civil disobedience? Perhaps the most extreme example was stated, ironically enough, by Thomas Jefferson. He said the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. This was prompted by the Shays Rebellion, and Jefferson expanded upon the thought when he said that God forbid we should ever be 20 years without such rebellion. Let them take arms. 20 years ago, we had a Supreme Court decide an election for Bush without waiting for the actual returns from Florida, usurping the individual rights of voters. Is this the year, 20 years later, for our rebellion? Does it have to be violent? Henry David Thoreau wrote an essay on civil disobedience. Many of us read it perhaps years ago before we had become politically sophisticated. He said government is at best but an expedient. The objections one could bring against a standing army, he thought, could be brought against a standing government. He was concerned in 1849 that the government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. Thoreau could have been talking about our government today. He warned back then that this American government, what is it but a tradition, though a recent one, endeavoring to transmit itself unimpaired to posterity, but each instant losing some of its integrity. Our government, our present government, has lost a lying king's share of its integrity. Governments show us how successfully men can be imposed upon, even impose on themselves for their own advantage. Trump, like his niece said, is a self-seeking, amoral man. Thoreau didn't want no government, but he wanted a better government. So do we. Thoreau asked, must the citizen ever for a moment or in the least design resign his conscience to the legislator? No, of course not. They may not like it, but we should not do that. The only obligation any person has is to do at any time what he thinks right. Thoreau said, all men recognize the right of revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. Among the causes for Thoreau was the fact that a sixth of the population of a nation which has undertaken to be the refuge of liberty are slaves. Has there ever been a more tyrannical government than we suffer now? It came in fits and starts, but it's there now. When unjust laws exist, he asks, shall we be content to obey them? Thoreau put the question, if the injustice of the government is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say break the law. Let your life be a counter friction to stop the machine. What laws have the protesters broken? Perhaps only the police and Trump's stormtroopers, his militias. The best way to sum this up is don't lend yourself to the wrong you condemn. If black men are killed by the police and you stand by and do not protest in some way or other, have you loaned yourself to a wrong that you condemn? I think so. When does a protester know he or she is right? Thoreau said, any man more right than his neighbors constitutes a majority of one already. How much of an effect must you make? For it matters not how small the beginning, Thoreau wrote. What is once well done is done forever. Thoreau decried a government which imprisons unjustly. The true place for a just man is also a prison. What about a government that kills by its agents, by the police? Does that not also make a prison for a just man if you do nothing? Our voices must afflict the ear of the state. The words of freedom and equal justice are robust. We must let the state know how much truth is stronger than error. There is only one truth. And how much more eloquently and effectively are those who can combat injustice who have experienced a little in his own person? Those men who were concerned for themselves were persons of color, but more concerned for their sons. Cast not a single vote, but your whole influence. Throw yourself entirely into the effort. A minority is powerless while it conforms to the majority. It's not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. Is our demonstration clogging government as usual? I think so, at the least. We haven't gone away. But we haven't gone away because the reforms that are necessary haven't been implemented. Quoting Confucius, Thoreau repeated, if a state is governed by the principles of reason, poverty and misery are subjects of shame. If a state is not governed by the principles of reason, riches and honor are subjects of shame. Thoreau found from being locked up himself that the state never intentionally confronts a man's sense, intellectual or more, only his body, his senses. It is not armed with superior wit or honesty, but with superior physical strength. If a plant cannot live according to nature, it dies, and so a man. Finally, Thoreau said, there will never be a really free and enlightened state until the state comes to recognize the individual as a higher and independent power from which all its own power and authority are derived and treats him accordingly. That's why our form as a republic is superior to the form that Trump prefers, a monarchy. Thoreau was a peace lover, and he believed in peaceful revolution, but he spoke of John Brown in a different manner for his attack at Harper's Ferry. In 1859, he wrote a plea for John Brown for doing something when others only wrung their hands against slavery. In Thoreau's mind, Brown gave his life for justice. He asked, when were the good and the brave ever in a majority? When I was younger, a hero of mine was William O. Douglas, part of FDR's Brain Trust, a legal scholar and an associate justice of the Supreme Court. I would have loved to clerk for him. He only took his clerks from Washington State. So he told me. And I don't know that he would have found me qualified otherwise. But he said he wrote all his own opinions. In the 60s, when there were demonstrations, protests, Justice Douglas wrote a book called Points of Rebellion. He decried the lack of moral imagination, a problem we find in the present Republican Party. Douglas insisted we needed bold and adventuresome attitudes. The question begged by Jefferson, Thoreau, and Douglas, is violence necessary? Can the revolution, the protest, be peaceful? This one has been mostly peaceful. There have been provocateurs, but the demonstrators have been mostly peaceful. In the 60s, Douglas thought it could be a revolution in the nature of an explosive political regeneration. It depends on how wise the establishment is. If with its stockpile of arms, it resolves to suppress the dissenters, America will face, I fear, an awful ordeal. Perhaps we're about to face that ordeal here, because Trump is not wise. Trump has entertained the forces of bigotry and violence and sicked these dogs of war on those who only want to be equal and safe from police violence. Trump himself has found himself comfortably embraced by violence, gathered up the weapons of war to greet protesters who only want justice for all. Like I said, wise is not the term we associate with Trump. Trump is a weak man who has those brutal factors he uses, muscle, iron, steel, gas, to his dirty work, as any fascist has or would. Trump is not going to Kenosha this Tuesday to do justice. He goes there to fan the fires of division and hate because he's opposed to what they protest, equal justice before the law, with which he cannot agree. And he cannot imagine an election victory that doesn't depend on hate and fear against any person of color. I hope you found this walk through some past authorities of interest different than the walk and talks of the regular day. Please subscribe if you haven't already. I'll have another podcast next Sunday. All the best. Be safe till then. Bye-bye.